Hello again, everybody, and good evening. Once again, we are coming to you from Tehran. This is a very special day here in Tehran. In fact, in the entire nation of Iran, as you well know from our coverage this week, talking to many of the officials here in Iran, as well as many of the people of Iran, which has been, if you don't mind my saying now as an aside, somewhat surprising for me, the transparency, the wish that they have to reach out to the outside world. It almost seems like for too long, the outside world, especially the Western media, has not come here to really talk about the Iranian people. They've spent more of their time, which is somewhat understandable, talking about the issues that involve Iran rather than talking to the people of Iran. And I think to a certain extent, we've been very happy that we've been able to do that this week. We're here, obviously, for three reasons. One of them has to do with the international negotiations that are going on right now between the United States and the Iranian government to try and figure out how the Iranian government can get America to minimize or end the sanctions which are crippling the economy here in Iran. While, of course, on the other side, the Americans want the Iranians to give them some kind of guarantee that they will not continue to enrich uranium to a level where they would be able to use it for any kind of nuclear weaponry. The other part of the story, which has been taking place all week, is the domestic situation here in Iran, which is very difficult. And the people talk about it. The officials who I've interviewed have been very transparent. And I've asked them very difficult and tough questions, and they've answered the questions. And they accept some culpability for what is happening here as well, outside of the sanctions that the United States has placed on this country. And that is that the currency in this country is at remarkable levels. 1.2 million is what you get for the currency of this country in comparison to one American dollar. That's remarkably difficult for the people of this country. And they're complaining. And some of the people in the protests are complaining for that very reason. So that's the background, right? That's the setup. I've set the table for you for what's happening today. And this that you're seeing now on camera as you look at these images is a very, very important day in this country. This is the day when the people of their country celebrate, if you would, their independence. For my fellow Americans who are watching this newscast, it's somewhat akin to what we celebrate on July 4th, the day that we come out and say, We got our independence from the British many years ago. This is the day the Iranians feel that they got their independence from the British as well, ironically enough, and from America and other Western influences when they, in their minds, got rid of the Shah, who they felt was putting upon the people of this country and started their own way, so to speak. And that's what they're here celebrating. This is what is happening here. And those pictures that you're looking at right now, just below us here, is where all these people have gathered as they do every year. But this year is particularly special, obviously, because of the 12-day war and because of these negotiations that are going on with the United States. And you'll see some representations of this, by the way. You may see them now as you're looking at these pictures. You'll see people in the crowd who are particularly fervent about their anger at the United States, their anger at Israel in particular, even more so than the United States, because they feel that Israel has been in many ways putting upon the people of this country in ways that they don't feel is deserved. And they feel that in many ways, Israel has done the same thing in places like Syria and Libya and Iraq and Yemen. And they feel like they're kind of next in line. So again, that's the background. That's where we are. That's the setup for what is happening on this day. What I want to do now is, over the next hour, as we bring you this special exclusive newscast from Tehran, I want to bring in someone who knows much, much more than I do about this day, about these people, and about what has gotten us to this place. Let me introduce you to Dr. Fawad Izadi. He is a professor here in Tehran of history. He is also very well known very much followed both in this country and outside of this country. And he's good enough to join us now to talk about this very important day. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is so kind of you.
It's an honor.
You're very kind to say that. It makes me feel very good. We're happy to be here. We think it's important, speaking as journalists, to be here representing a side of the story that is not often told. So let's begin. Our viewers right now are looking at the pictures of the people who are celebrating this anniversary. Who are these people and what are they saying and why are they there? Take us through this.
The first point I wanted to make is I used to watch you on CNN and I'm a fan of your show and RT now. It's easy to talk about Palestine when you are in Tehran. And it's not easy to do that when you are on CNN, if you want to be truthful.
Yes.
And it shows that to talk about Palestine, you don't have to be an Iranian or an Arab or a Muslim. You just have to be a human being. And you are a great human being. So it's an honor to have you here and to talk to you. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the fact that I've somewhat been castigated throughout my career for saying things that in many ways the West doesn't want said. I've lost jobs. Things have been made very difficult for me in the West because of that. But as you know, Professor, and I think you adhere to the same, principles, it's more important to be able to look at yourself at the end of the day in the mirror and say, I told the truth, than it is just to get along. And that's not to be critical of people who get along by saying what they think they need to say, because I understand you have bills to pay and people have to do what they do. But I thank you for recognizing that.
Now, to your question.
Yeah, who are these people? Why are they there? Why is this day so special in Iran?
These are ordinary citizens. Many of them are experiencing the economic hardship that you talked about. They're from different walks of life. The pictures that you see generally tells the audience that there are no special people. Mm. For example, they are not from the necessarily lower segments of society or higher segments of society. Mm. We have a mix of people. This is the 47th year of the victory of the revolution in 1979.
So these people grew up with this. This is, you know, I made a comparison to the American Revolution, but the American Revolution was so many hundreds of years ago. This revolution is still fresh in the minds of these people. Many of those people in the streets were here in 1979.
Right. So if you're older, if you're 50 or older, you would remember the revolution. So they come to celebrate what they did 47 years ago, the older people.
Yeah.
And then their children and grandchildren come because the message of revolution has passed to the younger generation. And they realize that they need to save what they got in 1979 because you have the same countries, United States, UK, some
yes,
of these
yes.
Western countries that want to take away that achievement. The achievement was...
They feel like they're I said this in my intro, that they're being put upon by the United States and by the West in general.
Sanctions. We had in June a military attack. We had over 1,200 people killed, civilians. Mm. So the difficulties that the United States created for Iran since 1953, since the coup that brought the Shah back to Iran up to today, is very much fresh in people's mind.
Before we get too much into the thick of the, because we have to touch on the negotiations, I'm going to play for you some of my interview last night with Dr. Arachi, foreign minister of your country, who was kind enough to share some of the thoughts with me about how the negotiations are going with the Trump administration at this point. Before we do that, let's focus on the people. Who these people are, why they're here. I've got some tape I want to show you. This is some tape we got earlier today. And unfortunately, this is the images that Americans see, and then they wonder, well, do the Iranians really want peace? Here are some people on the streets today. This gentleman I think we're looking at now, he brought a homemade flag. Obviously, you're looking at this. This is not even a flag of the United States.
It's very much homemade.
It's a homemade flag, and now he's burning it to show his anger for America. And I think we have another one. I don't know if we're seeing it, but Moscow, if you can put this up for us. they look like caskets, if you will, representing the names of American military leaders, showing that if America attacks Iran, Iran will respond in kind. So when people in America see this, they think, oh, here we go again with a chance of death to Iran. Can you put this in perspective for us?
When they chant death to America, this is a shorter version of death to American foreign policy. And to make a slogan out of it, it becomes death to America. But you are an American, and you have been around, and I think you have footage of people realizing, when they realize you are an American, they show no hatred toward you.
Just the opposite. They've been excited, and they're curious, and they want to talk to me, and they want to embrace me. I've been surprised by that.
The reason is that they are upset about U.S. foreign policy, but they realize that Americans are also victims of that foreign policy, because when the presidents in the United States, the Epstein class, this is the new terminology that we have, when they get into this endless foreign wars, the American soldiers die, and generally young soldiers with young families.
But you have to realize as well that, maybe they don't, because they're just people, and people exercise their rights in different ways. But when you burn the American flag, that hurts. That's more than a symbol to Americans. It's sacrosanct to Americans.
So the suggestion I have for the people who feel like that,
yes,
don't take it personally. This is not an attack on America. This is a criticism of U.S. foreign policy. And I have been watching the footage out of Minnesota. You see Americans doing the flag upside down.
Yes.
This is a sign of protest. Few people here and there even have been burning. I don't know where they learned that burning American flag idea, but some people are showing their dislike. Americans don't hate their country, but they hate what Trump is doing to immigrants in Minnesota and other places. So this is an issue of criticizing policies, not nations or people.
You know, it's a fair comparison that you make, and it makes me think that, to a certain extent, the fact that Mr. Trump is threatening your country because your country has punished harshly the protesters, interestingly enough, soon after he said that, there was what many are calling the murder of a protester in the United States. Almost like, dare I say, that action, that incident in America, which is, by the way, caused huge protests all over the United States in at least 10 different American cities, has made it more difficult for Mr. Trump then to attack Iran, if that was his intention, using that as the reason for doing so.
You know, when Iranians go to the United States, some Iranian immigrants, the television stations, Farsi speaking in Los Angeles and some of the cities that have a bigger Iranian population, teach Iranians about how you need to deal with the American police.
Huh.
Because how the police here deals when they stop a car and how the U.S. police deals with that person when they stop the car is very different. In Iran, it's customary. If police stops you, you get out of the car and you try to argue your way out of not getting a ticket.
Interesting.
And they tell these Iranian television stations, they tell that if you do that in the United States, you may get shot.
Yes.
So don't do that. You need to put your hands
on
the wheels. And if you want to get your insurance, you need to get permission from the police.
Yeah.
In Iran, the police does not have the right to shoot, even if they feel their life is threatened. They need to have permission to use their gun. And with the riots that we had here in January, we lost over 300 policemen because of that reason.
Yeah.
Because they knew, you know, they're trained and they have guns. They knew that this is serious danger to them. But since they did not have permission, because if they shoot, then they will be court-martialed. So the Western media outlets generally forget to mention that the people engaged in these riots were a tiny, tiny minority of the Iranians. Trump forgets to do that. They call those people Iranian protesters, and they ignore what you saw this morning in Tehran. These people are apparently not Iranians. So this is the problem that we generally have, that they, when they want to attack a country, they start demonizing that country. And one great thing as a good journalist you have done is that you have talked to ordinary citizens. That's important. Why? Because when Americans start bombing a city in Tehran, these people get killed.
Yeah, yeah. You're making reference especially to the children who have come up to me throughout my trip here and wanted, with curious, childlike questions.
We lost over 200 children when the, obviously not military people, over 200 children when the Americans attacked, U.S. government attacked Iran in June.
I want to play something for you. This is the president of Iran. Earlier today, he was in the crowd, as have many ministers as well who've joined them, speaking to this crowd just a little while ago. Let's go to that if we possibly can. Here it is.
The people of Iran rose up to establish justice, ensure independence, and show the world that Iranians and Muslims can, with their ability, will, knowledge, and skill, build their country and bring dignity and freedom. From the very first days of the revolution, the enemies tried to destroy our fledgling movement through actions such as creating division and staging coups. Now, more than ever, we need the wise guidance of the leader of the Islamic Revolution to set aside problems and divisions, bring different views together, and lead towards a clear goal.
So, what do you think of Mr. Pereshkian's comments?
You know, he's a heart surgeon, and I don't think he thought he would get elected. I think he came in as a candidate to make sure that he's a reformist candidate. He was a reformist candidate. He wanted to make sure that his party had enough representation within, you know, among the people who were present. In Iran, we don't have this system of primary elections, within a party. So two or three reformist candidates are available, or more. And they run on the idea of normalizing relations with the United States, lowering tensions. So one of the ideas that he represented when he was running was that I would talk to the American government and I would try to basically get rid of this mistrust that existed between Iran and U.S.
And that's important to the people of Iran, a large sector of the people of Iran.
And they voted for him.
Because reaching out to the United States.
Exactly.
Because they want those damn sanctions eliminated.
Exactly.
Because they want their lives to be normal.
And this is what he's trying to do today. You know, the reason he's sending his foreign minister to Oman, especially after the experience that Iran had. Iran was attacked in the middle of negotiations in June. The Vetkov, the U.S. representative, was supposed to go to Oman, officially announced that he will be there. Araghchi was supposed to go there. And then the U.S. attacked, Israel attacked, 2 days before the next round of negotiations. So you would imagine when you have an experience with a government that attacks you in the middle of negotiations, the last thing you want to talk about is negotiating with that government.
Yeah.
And since this is a reformist candidate, a reformist president, and he is staying with his promises, he is trying diplomacy one more time. And I'm not sure if he's going to be disappointed or not, but he's giving peace another chance because they realize that when war happens, Iranians will get killed. This time, I think Americans in good numbers will get killed. And then the whole region will be in serious jeopardy.
It's interesting. I woke up yesterday morning and we've been covering this story now for a good, 4 or 5 days since we've been here. And we're so busy working. We get up like at 7 o'clock. We finish like at 1 o'clock in the morning. And it's the kind of experience where you're just going through it. So you don't get to really see what your coverage is. So when I woke up the other day, I had a chance because my internet was finally working. And I was able to go on the internet and I saw what people are saying on Twitter and what people are saying on YouTube. And I got two reactions that I want to share with you. One is, Mr. Sanchez, this is horrible. You're basically a stooge for the Iranian government. Every word that comes out of your mouth was written by them. They have prepared
was
all...
It? Was
you,
it?
You have prepared all, they have prepared all your scripts, and even those children that came to you, they were put there by the government. So people are convinced that the only reason I'm here is because I'm at the behest of the government of Iran. I'm working for them. They're telling me what to say at all times. And I know you're looking at me with those curious eyes. No, that's not true. That's not true. The government, I have tried. In fact, I've been critical of the government. I spoke to the spokesperson recently and I told her, I said, you have some culpability here. You do. And she said, yes, we do.
Yeah. Can I mention the name of one of your competitors? One of these Western?
Of course.
BBC. I was watching BBC the other day, 2 days ago. They were covering about 100 monarchists, the people who want to bring the same type of government that the revolution overthrew.
You call them monarchists?
They are.
These are people who are still loyal to the Shah and his ideology?
Yes.
That's what you call them, monarchists?
Monarchists.
Interesting. Yes. Continue.
They were demonstrating in front of the White House, about 100 people, maybe less. And then BBC was covering the story in a way that they are supporting demonstrations that are happening today. And you have been in Tehran for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
There are no demonstrations, riots. We had a huge demonstrations today. So this is how BBC is operating. They are just telling lies to their audience. The last time we had riots, quote, or slash demonstrations, was more than a month ago.
Yeah.
And they are covering the news in a way that you think that, you know, people are engaging in, you know, street fights. That is not journalism. That is propaganda. What you do is journalism.
What I do is journalism.
Exactly.
Well, I think what I do is try to come here and tell the story. Part of the story is, yes, the Iranian government does have a security force, and they are quite stringent, and they're very careful about who gets into the country. Obviously not careful enough, because they tell me, and I asked them, I said, your security is not very good. They said, what do you mean? I said, you keep telling me that these instigators and infiltrators got into the crowd and they attacked, and they were members of Mossad, etc. Why did you let them in?
Good point. That's good journalism. And Mike Pompeo tweeted
this very idea. Yeah.
He sent them New Year greetings. It's still available. He hasn't taken it down. He says, New Year greetings to Iranian demonstrators and Mossad agents that are walking with them.
Yeah.
And it is true. The government here has...
And by the way, to be fair, we've given no guarantees. No one has written my scripts. In fact, do you see scripts here? Am I reading anything? No, right? We're talking.
You're just doing journalism.
And we're
this
on
is
the
normal
air.
Journalism. Good quality journalism, but it's normal journalism.
I can say whatever I want, and
exactly.
You can say whatever
exactly.
You want. And by the way, it's already gone. So once I say it, it's been edited, right?
Yeah.
I want to share something else with you now. This is from yesterday. I went in the streets of Tehran, and I just took a microphone and talked to people. And I stopped people. I stopped mullahs, self-described mullahs. I said, yes, I'm a mullah. And I told them, I said, you know, in my country, we think that you're kind of crazy radicals, you know, religious radical fanatics, I told him. He laughed. He goes, yeah, I understand why people might think that way. But I was very transparent in my questioning. I asked people in general, were they fearful that they were on the brink of being attacked? And it's interesting, they weren't. They said, no, we're not. I said, come on. Mr. Trump has said he's going to attack your country at any moment. Don't you spend most of your time looking up, waiting for the bombs? And they kept saying, no, we don't. So here's a cross-section of some of the people that I got a chance to talk to. I want to share this with you. Here it is. What is your name?
Mehmoudi Hassan.
Everybody is worried that there's going to be a war between the United States and Iran. Are you worried? Are you scared right now?
No, we are not worried. What should we be afraid of?
Well, you should be worried that Mr. Trump says he's going to bomb you, and he has big bombs and an armada off the coast of your country.
Mr. Trump is a businessman, and he makes good deals.
And what? And you are a professor as well?
No, I have studied in Islamic college.
And pardon me for my ignorance, but you're dressed as a religious man. What is your title religiously?
Mullah, I think in other country, Mullah, yes.
You know, it's funny, in America and in the West, sometimes when they say mullah, people become afraid, like, oh, the mullahs, like they're bad people. But you're not a bad person.
We should talk with the other people about their opinion. I'm simple people like other people.
You're not.
It makes no difference. This stress shouldn't separate mullahs with other people.
You're smart people. You know your leaders, your president, Reshkin, my president, Mr. Trump. Do you think they're just negotiating with strong words? Or do you think they're crazy enough to actually go to war?
No, they are talking in a strong word. United States is a power. Iran is a power. We should negotiate in the same place. I think we should think about our people. In my own opinion, we should follow our leader. As the leader say, we should stay obey. We
your
should
people
obey.
Or my people?
Your people and our people. They are following Trump. We are following Ayatollah Khamenei. It makes no difference. We should obey our leaders. And the leader...
Is it okay to question the leader? Is it okay to question your president or the supreme leader and say, wait, no, I don't agree. Can you disagree?
I think they understand better because they have a helicopter opinion.
Is it okay for the people to disagree? Is it okay for the people to protest? You say no or yes, as a man, as a mullah.
Yes.
So it sounds like you think it's just a negotiation.
I think so, yes. Because national interests are more important to politicians and are not solely achieved through war.
So you're not worried? You're not walking around the streets thinking a bomb's going to fall on your head any minute now?
Not only me, no Iranian is scared.
Thank you very much. I was really taken by the fact that they tell me we do not fear an attack. We don't think it's going to happen. We're living our lives. And if it comes, we have all the confidence in the world that our government will protect us. And for a moment, I thought, yeah, you're saying that because you think the government's going to watch this and they're afraid that if you don't say this, they're going to be mad. But no, I really got the sense it's almost in the, this civilization is 6,000 years old. This is not your first fight. This is not your first battle. It's almost in your genes.
And we have survived. We have survived aggressors, invaders, crazier people than Trump, if you can imagine that. And there is this culture of resistance. There is this culture of resistance in Iran. We have been under American sanctions for 47 years. And people realize that the country needs to get stronger. That's how you can get rid of these type of threats.
But what about those who don't? I talk to a lot of young people here. And Professor, they're so tired of this. They're just tired. They want this to stop. They want to just live normal lives where they're not under the threat of war, where their economy doesn't suck. What do you say to them? Where's the hope for them?
You know, I teach at University of Tehran, and we have this type of students all the time with the same questions that
you
just mentioned.
What do you tell them?
We tell them that the country is very rich. Iran is number one in terms of oil and gas.
Yeah.
That's a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, in Latin America, you got about 20 countries. The only country that Trump was interested in was Venezuela. Paraguay, Chile, Argentina, not concerned about those countries. This is a problem that we have. And this is why you had the coup in 1953, because the British wanted to keep Iranian oil. You know, this is after World
War. You're talking about Mohammad Mossadegh, who was elected by the people, essentially, because he would be the new leader of Iran to get rid of the, as you say, monarchs and give the oil and the resources of this country back to the people. And for that, the MI6 and the CIA eliminated.
Exactly. And we have one problem that Venezuela doesn't have, and that's Israel. The Israeli lobby is quite powerful in Washington. As you know, there are some victims.
As a matter of fact, I think if we could,
Those of you in the booth, could you do me a favor and put the pictures up? We just received the pictures today of Bibi Netanyahu arriving in Washington. Mr. Netanyahu, as you see here in these videos, chose to go to Washington somewhat as a bit of a, maybe, I don't know if this word is too strong, an emergency visit to Washington based on the fact that he was reading that the negotiations between Mr. Arachi, the foreign minister of Iran, and Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner was going well. And as a result of it going well, he decided to go to Washington to have a meeting with Mr. Trump. And that's this video that you're looking at right now. What do you make of that, Professor?
The Israeli lobby is active in Washington. He's providing additional support. He wants to make sure that the policy of aggression towards Iran will continue until the end of the Trump administration. They basically want to repeat what they did in 1953. They want to overthrow the government, and this time I think they want to disintegrate the country. They want to separate the oil rich section, put a monarch there, like some of the monarchs that we have on the southern part of the Persian Gulf, make sure that oil belongs to them. You know, when you listen to Trump, he says that he controls 55% of world's oil. And how did he get that number? He's adding Venezuelan oil to American oil. Yeah. That's what he's doing. When he was talking to the executives of major oil companies in the United States, he was telling them that don't worry about the Venezuelan government. You are dealing with me if you want to go into that market. Which is very strange, because if you are an oil company and you are trying to invest or extract oil in another country, you need to get permission from that country.
Let me share something else with you. This is part of my conversation yesterday with Foreign Minister Arachi, who was kind enough to sit with me last night and share with me, give me an update, if you will, on the negotiations so far with Mr. Kushner, Mr. Bradley, Commander Bradley, and Mr. Witkoff. And there was a place where I asked him, I said, okay, so what happens if the negotiations break down? What happens if you're not in agreement on sanctions for the United States or uranium enrichment, which he took me through very specifically, which is the demand that the United States has of Iran? And everything falls apart and we end up with a war. We end up with the United States hitting your country. What happens next? He talks about it and gives me the answer, which is the same answer you know, I know, and our viewers know, which is Iran says this time they're ready. They will attack. They will attack the countries, especially the countries in the Gulf region where the United States has military bases. But then after he says that, I sense in him that he's uncomfortable talking about it. So I asked him, I said, you don't look comfortable to me. He then is taken aback. Watch this moment. I want to share it with you. Here it is.
What would your retaliatory strategy then be?
We defend ourselves.
How?
You know how.
You would attack the U.S. bases in the Gulf countries?
We would attack U.S. and U.S. assets and facilities, everything they have in our neighborhood.
You seem almost uncomfortable saying that. Are you?
I am? No, I'm not uncomfortable. The only point is I don't want to express something.
Yes.
Which I don't like it to happen.
Of course.
I'm a man of diplomacy. I'm a man of dialogue. I'm a man of negotiation. And everybody knows me. I have done it in the past, and I can do it again. I'm not the man of war, of course. Yeah. I have a war veteran myself.
Yes.
My country, our armed forces are fully prepared for any eventuality. But my preference is diplomacy.
It was interesting. I think he was taken aback by my question. But I think when he looked me in the eyes and caught my glance, he was telling me, and you heard him say it, I'm a negotiator. I'm not a man of war. I'm a man of negotiations. My job is to cut a deal. So when I said
you look uncomfortable talking about this attack and this threat, we're going to kill him and da, da, da. It was almost like it didn't fit him. It was a suit that didn't fit. Do you understand what I'm saying?
You know, he negotiated the 2015 agreement. Dr. Zarif was the foreign minister, and he was deputy foreign minister, mostly in charge of negotiations because the foreign minister is busy with other stuff. Yeah. So this issue is very personal to him. He has invested many years of his life.
He wants to see this deal done.
Exactly. And he's dealing with Trump, changes his mind all the time under the influence of the Israelis. And he's very disappointed because a good portion of his life's work may go up the smoke because of the situation that we have in Washington. And he doesn't like that. This is very personal to him.
I'm glad you said that. Let me play another one. Here's Foreign Minister Araghchi talking about trust. This is interesting because, remember, these are human beings having a discussion, and he's telling me, Rick, I want to trust, but it's hard to trust because of what America has done to us, the United States has done to us in the past, specifically during the 12-day war. Here's some of that conversation. Take a listen.
We still do not have full trust on Americans.
Yeah.
And I think we have every right not having trust, because the last time we negotiated, last June, we were in the middle of negotiations.
Yes.
when they decided to attack us. And that was a very, very bad experience for us. And we
need, so what's it going to take to get you to the level of trust that you think is necessary?
Well, we need to make sure that that scenario is not repeated. And this is mostly up to Americans to make that assurance.
Do you need Mr. Trump to tell you personally that, since he's the one who broke the promise last time?
We need a guarantee. We need an objective guarantee that the same scenario is not going to be repeated, and the United States is not using force to resolve differences.
Trust. He's talking about trust.
Yeah.
And he's surprisingly, again, one of the things I've experienced here that surprised me is how transparent with me these officials have been. They've told me things I didn't expect them to share with me. Human emotions, culpabilities, their own sadness, their own wishes for stuff. And here he is basically saying, look, I want to trust him, but it's hard.
The history is very difficult. And it's not just Iran. You look at the history of the United States. Violating agreements is something that the government of that country does most of the time. And when you are a reformist government, you want to fix these issues diplomatically, and the other side is not really interested. The demand they have is that they say that you should limit the range of ballistic missiles to 300. That means that if they attack Iran, Iran cannot respond in any serious manner. And these are unreasonable demands, maximalist demands. And when you are a diplomat trying to find solutions, you need to have some material to work with. You cannot start with this type of ideas. So I think the policy in Washington is more or less, the planning is, I think they're going towards war. And one reason they are engaging in these diplomatic talks is to influence public opinion in the United States. Because as you know, starting another war in the Middle East is not popular among the Americans. It's not popular in Congress. Because of the War Powers Act, Trump may have to go and get a vote out of Congress.
No. It goes beyond that. One of the reasons that this war, potential war, is not popular right now in the United States is because the American people, for the very first time in my generation, in my lifetime, are fed up with Israel. Let me just say it. They're fed up with Israel.
Yeah.
Not the Israeli people, of course, or I've been to Israel. I love Israel.
Fed up with Netanyahu.
They're fed up with a system where Americans are now asking, not CNN, which is
you know, owned by the establishment, not NBC, not the New York Times. No, I'm talking about the people in social media who now have a bigger audience than CNN. People like my own following, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens, Cenk Uygur, and many, many, many others who are saying, okay, every time we get into a war, we do it for Israel. Every time we have money, we give it to Israel. Hundreds of billions of dollars would go to Israel. And the more we give them, the more they expect of us. And as Americans, we're just asking, mostly Republicans, by the way, more than Democrats, are saying, when is enough enough? Yeah. How much more? Now we have to fight another war, this time with Iran, after we fought a war with Iraq and Syria and Libya and everywhere else. So there is right now, I can tell you this as an American, that there is a feeling in America for the first time in a long time that they are fed up. And one of the reasons they don't want to do this is not so much because of Iran or anything else. Iran just happens to be the next conquest. It's because they're starting to get angry that they feel that they're basically led by the nose by an Israeli establishment, this time led by Mr. Netanyahu, who's telling them, it's never enough.
And it was supposed to be America first, not Israel first.
Your point is valid.
For the last year since Trump has been president, in this part of the world, whatever he has done has been in the interest of Israelis. They are trying to dominate this whole region. If they get rid of Iran, they can use the oil from this part of the world to put pressure on China, to put pressure on Russia.
Let me tell you something, though, and I don't know what your take is on this, but you may think Mr. Trump is crazy. You may think many things of Mr. Trump. But let me tell you something about my president, as bizarre as it may sound, and maybe as paradoxical as this may sound. As a man who's been a journalist for so many years and so many decades and followed and watched so many presidents, I've interviewed Mr. Carter, Mr. Obama. I've interviewed many U.S. presidents and many U.S. statesmen. And I have found that they've always said just the right words. It's always about, we're doing this because of democracy. We're doing this to protect the rights of people. We're doing this because it's the right thing to do. They always have used the pretty words, but they've done the same damn thing time and time again in places that I wish they had not done, whether it's the place where I come from in Latin America or in the Middle East. Mr. Trump is brusque. He uses language that is not the language of a diplomat. But in the end, I think he's, because of that, I find him more honest, and I also find that he's less of a war president than some of the war presidents we've had, like Bush, Cheney, Obama, before him, which he, by the way, has criticized for those wars. I say this because I think there's a glimmer of hope in all of this. You may disagree with me, that in the end, Mr. Trump's words may be difficult and tough and mean, but I don't think his actions will end up being that way, because I don't think he wants war, despite what Bibi wants to convince him of. And I think Bibi fears that side of Trump, and that's why he's coming to Washington. Am I crazy?
No, and neither is Trump. The problem that I think we have is that once you start this war machine, you know, he has sent Abraham Lincoln, he's saying that he's sending another one. Once this American war machine starts moving, it becomes very difficult to stop it. And this is what happened in Venezuela when you had all these troops there. They needed to do something, and that's very dangerous.
Venezuela was not a war.
I know.
It was maybe a kidnapping,
but
he ended it without having to do a war.
And you cannot do that in Iran.
Well, of course.
So the other
too big a country with too big a military.
Exactly. So the other option would be war. So I'm really worried about war, not because Trump wants it, but because he's moving towards that direction, which is very, very difficult. And I think this is an opportunity for the American people, for people in the U.S. Congress, realizing these type of Middle Eastern wars bring no good to the United States. If they don't stop this process now, then it may be too late to do anything about it in a few weeks.
It may be more difficult this time, and I know we're getting to the end of the hour. It may be more difficult this time. Remember, Americans were lied to about the Iraq War. We were told that
Saddam Hussein's troops were going into Kuwait and crushing the heads of little babies in incubators. And we were told that Saddam Hussein had massive nuclear weapons that he was about to use in America. It was all a lie. And I think we know that now. Every American knows that, Democrat or Republican. And I think to a certain extent, it will be harder to lie about the United about the intentions of Iran right now.
You know, if you're worried about Iran's nuclear program, the best thing to do is to inspect Iranian sites. And this is what you had in 2015 nuclear agreement, the most extensive levels of inspection that no country was under. So the agreement that Obama got out of Iran was very strong in terms of making sure that there is no nuclear weapons. And the limit for enrichment was 3.5%. You know, we don't
3.65
have
3.65, as the foreign minister told me
exactly,
yesterday.
Exactly, exactly.
To be exact.
And exactly. And you don't find any nuclear scientist that would tell you that you can make a nuclear weapon with 3.65% enrichment. You need over 90%. So the best way to make sure that Iran's nuclear program stays peaceful is to reach an agreement like that. And it was Trump that left the agreement. One reason was that it was Obama's agreement. But he has an opportunity in this reformist government to get something very serious on nuclear program, stop these demands on ballistic missiles. You know, it could be something like, you know, on ballistic missiles, he could make Iranians sign a document that they would not use ballistic missiles unless they're attacked. No. So there are ways of getting around some of these
issues. There's plenty of room for negotiation, and I think there's plenty of room for some kind of agreement. And I do believe, in the end, Professor, that Mr. Trump is willing to come up with a compromise, as long as the compromise gives him something Obama didn't have, because he would look foolish if he ends up with the same deal Obama had.
I think the Iranian side is ready for that. We just have to wait and see if we can make sure that Netanyahu fails in his trip to Washington today.
You have been so kind to give us so much of your time.
Sure, thank
you. This has been a very interesting, and once again, and I know to a certain extent, people at home are watching us now, and some will criticize us and say that you were planted here and I was supposed to ask you certain questions.
You're just doing normal journalism, good quality normal journalism.
We thank you, sir.
BBC and CNN are framing Iran as a demon so they can give that opportunity to Trump to attack Iran, which is not a good idea. That's not journalism.
Iran should be criticized when they're wrong. Iran should be praised when they're right. And so should the Western countries. And too often we only play one side. Our job is to tell the truth globally, and that's why we do what we do. So, you know, on behalf of all these people behind us who are celebrating their revolution on this day, a very important day for them, and on behalf of yourself and our crew here in Tehran, this has been, for me, in many ways, an eye-opening trip. This has been an historic experience for us as a news organization as well. An important story that I'm glad we told. I didn't know what to expect. We had no idea. I didn't even know I was going to be doing this on this day. I didn't even know when they were celebrating the revolution, to be very honest, and I hope you're not insulted by that. But my idea here was just to come talk to everybody I could to get a better understanding of this country. And I think we've been able to at least share that with people, and then they can draw their own conclusions.
Keep up the good work.
Once again, you're very kind. Thank you so much. Once again, it has been a very interesting set of circumstances that we've covered for you throughout the week. My thanks to you, as I always say, for letting us into your homes. And I invite you, those of you who've been watching, the numbers are amazing. Millions of you have been watching and commenting from all over the world. I invite you to continue to comment, and please feel free to criticize, feel free to tell me what I missed. Tell me what I may have gotten wrong. Tell me what I may have gotten right. It's all accepted, as we say. And thank you once again for your time. We'll be looking for you next time. I'm Rick Sanchez, reporting once again from Tehran.